Good morning, everyone. I'm going to start off with a short story that I want to tell you to illustrate something. But I want to first explain to anyone who may not have ever heard of what a Bedouin is. A Bedouin is kind of a nomad who lives in the desert in kind of arid regions in the Middle East. You encounter them. There's not a lot of them anymore, but they've pretty much existed since the time of Abraham. They live off the desert. They live in the desert. It's the life they know, and they continue from generation to generation. I've personally been in the desert and have stayed with some of these individuals. It's amazing the amount of hospitality that they show. They will give you anything, and it's actually an insult to them if you don't take it. And so with that kind of background, I want to tell a story so that it kind of makes sense to you. So there were two men who were crossing the desert in one of these type of regions, and they came upon this Bedouin's tent as they were needing shelter, and he welcomed them into his tent like any Bedouin would. And he took one of his goats and killed it for a dinner for the gentleman who needed refreshment. And they stayed the night, gave them a place to stay. The next day, they continued to stay with this Bedouin man, and he killed another goat. And the two individuals were astonished, the two travelers were astonished, because they hadn't finished eating the first one yet. But the man said he would be ashamed to give them meat that wasn't fresh. So on the third day, the two strangers decided that they were going to have to leave. But the Bedouin man was not in the tent for the morning, only his wife was there. They said that they were sorry, but they had to go before the sun caught them in its hot part of the day. And so they gave the wife I'm just going to say dollars because their currency is not going to make any sense. But anyways, so gave them some money, not a lot, but they apologized that they couldn't wait, so they left. And they traveled for a few hours before they heard a voice behind them. And they realized that it was this Bedouin man that had caught up to them, and he was shouting. And as soon as he caught up to them, they could tell he was disturbed, and he took the money and he threw it down at their feet. And he said, "I gave you such a warm welcome. Aren't you ashamed of yourselves?" In surprise, the strangers weren't quite sure what to make of this. They realized that the goats were more than they had paid for and had given him reimbursement for. But they said they were sorry. They didn't have much money with them. The Bedouin man said, "I'm not talking about the amount of money. The desert welcomes the Bedouin wherever we go, and it never asks anything in return. If we had to pay, how would we live?" And the Bedouin man said, "Welcoming you into our tent was like paying back a fraction of what life has given us." And so you see this deep concern of hospitality, even to the point of being disturbed whenever someone doesn't understand the hospitality and the importance of giving hospitality. This is one thing I want you to keep in mind as we start off through this story and see if you can locate this thread. So our story continues in Antioch, where we have been in Jerusalem, and that's been kind of the focus. Now we've moved to Antioch, the Syrian Antioch, being... This is the wrong slide. There should be one in there that says Beyond Jerusalem. So anyways, we have been located in Jerusalem. Now the church has moved to Antioch. So the beginning of the text, which we're in today, which is chapter 13, verse 1, through chapter 14, verse 28, we find that there are prophets and preachers and teachers that are present. They're all gathered together. They're worshiping, and they're fasting, and they're having this community thing going on. And the Spirit says to them, "I want you to separate for me Barnabas and Saul for work that I have to do." So with this fasting and praying and laying on of hands, they were on their way. So I'm going to throw this map up here for you because in case you haven't put this in its context geographically before, it's actually kind of interesting to see the travels that he makes. So we're going to just try to follow along as I go through the story with you, and you can see where they are. So Antioch is over there on the right, highlighted with blue. And so their first stop they go to is Seleucia, which is the port of Antioch. So that's where they get on a ship, and they sail over to Salamis in the island of Cyprus. Now, what we know from our last chapter, or from chapter 11, is that Cyprus already had individuals there. There were already some types of missionaries there when they arrived. So they continue on, and they travel to the west, southwest corner of the island of Cyprus, to Paphos, it's called. And this pattern that we see at the very onset of this chapter and this story is that there's this pattern of taking the message to the heart of the Jewish community, but it doesn't stop there. It goes on into the Gentile community as we've continued to see this message push forward. Paul is called the apostle to the Gentiles in a couple places. Romans talks about it. Galatians chapter 2 talks about it. 1 Timothy even mentions it. And so it's not an idea that the Jews have been abandoned in any way. That's not what's happening here. And we'll touch on that just a little bit. But in Romans chapter 1, we have the description by Paul that saying that the gospel was being delivered to the Jew first, and then equally for the Greek as well, which when one says Greek, that's just another way of saying someone who is not Jewish. That's what it's signifying. So this mostly describes the practice that we find in our story as we go through Acts. So they journey through Cyprus. They come to the Paphos, which is the capital. And there they come into contact with the Roman governor, which I think some of the translations will say the proconsul. And so this man's name is Sergius Paulus. And we see initially here is that you have understand that the Roman governor is very high up in the Roman world, right next to the emperor himself. So this guy is big time. In the proconsul, the governor wants to hear more, which gives you an indication that the storyteller wants to tell you what kind of an impact that this message is already having. If the governor is inquiring about hearing more about this. Okay? So the writer, we'll call him Luke here, who's relaying this story to us, he wants you to be aware, and he's very aware, that the Roman world for which he writes, he's writing to people in the Roman world, he's very eager to portray to you that not all officials, not all Romans, and we found this, if you remember back in the story that we told about the soldiers, and remember Cornelius, and how he portrays Cornelius as being a righteous man, one who's seeking God. This is a centurion. Well, you have the same thing with the Roman governor. Here you have a man who's interested in hearing more about this Jesus, about this message. And so this writer is very interested in portraying that not all in high offices, in official positions, are endangering God's world or persecuting God's community. And so he's very particular about saying this. And I wanted to read you something by one of my favorite theologians, whose name is N.T. Wright. He's a New Testament scholar. He's a Pauline theologian, and he's a retired Anglican bishop. But in this context of speaking of what I'm just telling you, he said, "This is not unimportant for us to remember in our own world, where political polarization easily leads people into simplistic analyses and diagnoses of complex social problems, into a readiness to dismiss out of hand all authorities and anyone in power, whether locally or globally." And what he's saying is that a lot of times as Christians, or even just Americans in general, we can have a stereotypical attitude, lump them all in the same category. Are there corrupt officials? Of course there are. Are there corrupt people in authority? Of course there are. Are those who abuse authority? Yes, I'm sure we've all experienced that. But that doesn't make all of them evil and wicked and tyrants. God still has his purpose for those. And so it's not charitable for us as believers, even as people who live in this nation, to treat those in authority as though they are just automatically wrong because they have that position. I hope that makes sense. I think that's what the point the writer here is trying to make. That in a world where the Jews live, they hate the Romans. The Romans are everything that's wrong with the world. And so in this world, they can have the attitude that, well, he's a Roman. Of course he's wrong. Well, what about Cornelius? What about Sergius Paulus? You know, that type of idea. So I think that's something that we can take with us and say, check our attitude. And I'm not even talking about the current administration, whether it's on a national scale or a local scale. That's not the point. The point is that we need to to think about the way, consider the ways that we think and treat these individuals who are in a position that Paul says later that God has put them in these positions. So anyways, that little sidetrack note. At this place, we have some opposition by a man named Bar-Jesus, also known as Elymas, and he's called here a false prophet. And he's one who tries to steer the governor away from listening to this message. This is one of my pet peeves, and I touched a little bit on this last week. When we as Christians read the Bible a lot and we see all these words, we tend to get locked into terminology sometimes. So last week I talked about Christian and how Christian had a very significant meaning to it, what Christian initially meant. But yet to us sometimes that meaning can be lost just because we hear it so often. The word false prophet has kind of got that same type of negative slant within some uses today. Sometimes the word can be synonymous or used synonymously with somebody who doesn't believe the same way that we do. And so if this person over here believes a different thing than we do and we think he's teaching something that's heresy or what we call heresy, we say, well, he's a false prophet. He's teaching things that are wrong. That's not what false prophet means. False prophet is very specific, especially in the world of Scripture, because a prophet is one who speaks for the God. So you have prophets for the God of Israel, but you also had prophets for the God of Baal. And so a prophet was one who spoke for the God. A false prophet is one who speaks, who presents himself as speaking for the God, but yet speaks his own message instead. And so that's why Deuteronomy tells us how to recognize a false prophet, because, well, if he speaks for the God and the message is supposed to become true, if it doesn't come true, that means he didn't speak from the God. And so this isn't a type of terminology that just labels somebody who thinks differently than us or teaches something that we don't agree with. That's not what this is. This is a man who is claiming to speak for a specific God and is speaking a false message. That's what this means. Paul confronts this in our text, and he says, he's very specific, "You son of the devil, you enemy of all righteousness, full of all deceit and villainy, will you not stop making crooked the straight paths of the Lord?" Paul uses something here that's kind of interesting. If you remember back with me, back to the beginning of the book of Luke, remember what John the Baptist was. He was going to, Isaiah chapter 40 is quoted, "Prepare the way of the Lord, make his path straight, make a straight path in the in the desert, a highway for our God." And so John the Baptist is this one who's coming. The path of the Lord is presumably somewhat crooked. John the Baptist coming out and making a highway for the Lord, in the context meaning Jesus. He's preparing the way for Jesus. Well, Paul is taking this and turning it back around and saying, John the Baptist came, made the path straight for Jesus, and now you're coming along and you're making the straight path crooked again. And so he's saying you're perverting what God has made straightened. So because of his unbelief, because of the way that he was presenting himself and making trouble, the man is struck blind. After this, the governor believed. This is actually an almost identical scene to what we find with Peter. If you remember back to a story that we had not too long ago with a magician named Simon. Remember the magician? Now the outcome was slightly different, but you had the same type of magician and then the rebuke of the magician. Now, this is the first official convert, the official Gentile convert for Paul. And the writer begins calling him Paul at this moment. So we have called him Saul from the time we've been introduced to him. And now all of a sudden, the writer turns around and calls him Paul at this very moment. So naturally, the reader questions, well, why is Paul changing? Why is the name of Paul? Why is he Paul now instead of Saul? Well, there's lots of possibilities. One possibility is that this is not unusual for an individual who carries a Jewish name when he goes to, in the Greek world, to take on a Greek name so that he kind of fits the culture. He doesn't stand out like a sore thumb type thing. It's possible that Paul, Saul, had both of these names originally, because you see Tarsus on the map there. Paul lived in this region. This is home to him. He's closer to being home now in Antioch in with his travels than he was when he was in Jerusalem. So he's very acquainted with the Greek world. That's another possibility. The third possibility, which I think is probably the most likely, is that his first convert here is named Sergius Paulus. Now, the word Paulus is the exact same word that we translate Paul. So it's Sergius Paul. Paul. And so it's possible that Paul takes on the name of his first convert. We don't know. It doesn't really matter for the story, but it is interesting, and because from now on, he's Paul to us. They leave Paphos, and they arrive at this town, the city called Perga. And it's here in our story that John Mark, who's been accompanying them, leaves and returns to Jerusalem. Paul seems to take the lead. If you look at the text, it says that Paul and his companions. So it seems to indicate that Paul is kind of taking the lead here. And again, most likely it's because they're in Turkey, and this is Paul's hometown. He's about 200 miles from home at this point. So then they go up to Antioch from Perga in Pisidia. Now again, this is to differentiate the Antioch in Pisidia versus the Antioch you see on the right, which is in Syria. So we have two Antiochs there with the one on the left. So on the Sabbath day, it says that they went into the synagogue. Now this is a very common thing for Jews to do. If it's Sabbath, of course you go to synagogue. It's just what they do. And this gives us an important point to recognize that Paul is still a Torah observant Jew. He's still doing everything the way he had done before. Has he changed his direction? Has he changed his understanding of the Scriptures? Has he changed his focus? Of course he has. But that doesn't change what his past is, his ancestry, the faith of his fathers. None of that has changed. He's still a Torah observant Jew, as he believes his Bible speaks to him. Paul, when he comes here, he obviously has become somewhat well known, and he's invited to speak. This is actually almost, again, a parallel story to what had happened with Jesus. And again, I'm only speaking about this story within Luke and Acts. I'm not talking about in Matthew, in John, or Mark. This is just within Luke and Acts. But in Luke and Acts story, if you remember with me, Jesus goes into the wilderness to be tempted, right? And who does he meet? He meets the devil, and the devil tempts him. What happens right after Jesus comes out of that temptation? In Luke's story, he goes to the synagogue. What happens in the synagogue? Jesus is asked to speak and to read the passage. What happens after that? He's driven out of town. And so this is kind of the same pattern that's happening. So Paul stands up, he gives a sermon, not unlike Stephen had given. He had discussed Stephen's sermon, and then to Peter's sermon. So this is very much a similar story, a similar sermon that is presented, which the writer, our storyteller, wants us to see that there's a consistency between these individuals, that this message is kind of a unified message between them all. They accept it, and Paul is invited to speak next Sabbath, so a week from then. And at that time, the whole city gathers to hear this message. But then there's some opposition that arises by a certain group called the Jews. Now, again, I want to stop and make sure you understand that this isn't lumping in the whole ethnic group called the Jews. The Jews, as called sometimes, and we also find this in the Gospel of John, that there's a specific, very specified group that is called the Jews that sometimes give up opposition. We don't know exactly who these are. But again, this is important to me and to a lot of scholars who deal with the text, because it's exactly this reason of interpretation that has given rise to many years of anti-Semitism, to where the treatment of the Jews has been very poor, because it's the Jews that always hated Jesus. It's the Jews that killed Jesus. It's the Jews that never accepted. No, there were many, many Jews. The church began as Jewish, and the Gentiles were included later. Don't throw all of these individuals into the one lump just because of the word the Jews. It's a very specific, refined group who make this opposition. Not all those who are Hebrew or Israelite in their identity. So people they're stirred up against Paul and Barnabas here, and so much so that they left the region. And it says that they shook the dust off of their feet against them. Now, again, this is something that we find Jesus say in the book of Luke about shaking the dust of your feet off. This has to do with hospitality. If one of your brothers fails to provide for you, or treat you in a, or accept your message or whatever it is, you shake the dust of your feet. Basically, you relieve yourself of responsibility. I did what I was supposed to do. I kept my end of the deal. I did what God put on my chest. It's all on you from here on out. If you fail to accept, if you fail to show hospitality, that's your funeral. Because God is not going to hold me responsible. Does that make sense? So that's kind of what that, it's kind of an idiomatic phrase, one that's known in their culture, to shake the dust of their feet off against them. So then they're off to Iconium, having been roused some persecution. Nevertheless, despite what they just encountered, the disciples, they're filled with joy and with the Holy Spirit, it says. When they come to Iconium, they encounter the same thing. They encounter trouble. There's many who do believe, but there are those who refuse to believe and try to create opposition. Now, we find the same thing happen today. People really don't change that much. Different times, different contexts, but we have the same thing. You can find you can hold, say that you have an opinion, in a political opinion, for instance. I won't use the religious opinion thing right yet because we'll get into that. You may have a political opinion, and you may find somebody who maybe has a different opinion politically. Not saying this type of thing exists. I'm just saying that hypothetically, if somebody had a different opinion, you may find some opposition. Or trying to create opposition. Sometimes individuals feel it their responsibility to not only disagree with you, but to go out of their way to cause trouble for you, to make sure everyone else knows that you have this opinion and that it's not the right opinion. I think Facebook has magnified this problem. Or social media, I shouldn't specify Facebook. But anyways, I think this is also something that is very applicable today to checking our attitudes toward others who may not hold the same opinions we do about things and saying, is it our responsibility to try to slur behind this person's back or to cause a slanderous attitude? That's not our responsibility. So according to some Jews, what Paul was presenting, the message that is being presented, is heresy. Now, heresy, and I don't mean that in the proper term, heresy is actually a very proper term that's only can be done through the Catholic Church, because heresy actually has to be voted on. It's one of the canon laws of the Catholic faith. And so a lot of Protestants and individuals, you hear that word heretic thrown out. There's actually a very specific use of the word heretic, and so it's not really a fair use of that word. But otherwise, the Jews, they think that Paul... Some of these Jews think that Paul is preaching heresy, the wrong message. They don't believe what he believes. And it is interesting when you think about history, think about the origins of the Anabaptist movement, think about the origins of the Protestant Reformation, think about even the Jesus movement itself. A lot of the innovators and the reformers throughout history have been considered heretics at the time to everyone around them, because they're coming up with new ways to think about the text. They're coming up with new ways to think about God. Well, those aren't the old ways. Those ways can't possibly be right, because that's not the way we've always thought about it. And so a lot of times in their own time period, they're considered heretics. They may even suffer a martyr's death. You find that all through church history, people being killed because they thought outside the box. And so I think we need to be careful and sensitive to where God is leading people, because sometimes it may be different than we think it is or that we've always known it. And we have to be sensitive to the Spirit's direction in this. So there's some division. There's a division with some for and against the apostles and the message they represented here. The apostles learned of this threat that was against them, and they fled. So they fled to the cities of Lystra and Derbe. These are cities that are also in the region called Lycaonia. You see there in the gray highlighted above the word Iconium. So they continued to proclaim the message that they'd been proclaiming. Now we come to a really interesting part of the story. And this is one of my favorite parts. And this is kind of a climactic build up through chapter chapters 15 and then 16 and then into 17. And so it continues to escalate. And I really enjoy what's coming. So in Lystra, we find that Paul is met with a crippled man. And the text says that he was crippled from birth. Now, there's only two places in the entire book of Acts that say crippled from birth. Here is one of the places, and the first time it was mentioned was in chapter 3. Remember Peter and John going up to the temple to pray, and they met a man crippled from birth. It's almost the exact same story, the same scene happening here. And what the writer is wanting you to do, he's wanting to draw a parallel between Peter and Paul. Because in a lot of stories that happen in the Greek time, to emphasize your story, rather than to use all kinds of adjectives and colorful speech, what they would do was use a comparative, like type of a comparison. If Peter was great, look how awesome Paul is. So in both stories, you have a temple entrance, the going into the temple, a religious conflict takes place, and then after a miraculous event, a speech that explains the miraculous power. So Paul encounters this man, and he saw that he had faith to be healed. And Paul commanded him. He said, "Stand on your feet." So this, again, parallels the story of Peter. And so when the crowd saw it, it says that they began to shout in their native tongue. Verse 11, chapter 14. "The gods have come down to us in human form. The gods have come down to us." In a Jewish setting, like we've encountered at the temple with Peter in everything. Remember what happened at the healing that Peter did at the temple? People began to praise God, right? That was the response. But remember, right now where we are in the world, we're not in a Jewish setting. And that's not what the people did when they saw this healing and praise. They have a different conclusion. Their conclusion isn't praising God for the miraculous deed that just happened. Their conclusion is, the gods have come down in human form. Because only the gods can do things like that, right? And now, we get another very, very important piece. It says, they called Paul Hermes, and Barnabas they called Zeus. Now, why do you think the writer tells us this? There's actually a very important reason. You all know the story of the big bad wolf, right? The three little pigs. You all know the story of Jack and the Beanstalk, right? You've heard these from the time you were little. Well, they had their own set of stories that had been around for as long as anyone could remember. And the writer of Acts is putting this in the frame of one of the stories that they knew really well and brings out a major point. But if you don't know the story, you miss the point. And so I want to tell you that story right now and see if you can draw with me a conclusion about what this writer may be trying to tell us about the conclusion that these people arrive at and what the point of the story is that's being told in this the gods have come down to us idea. In the Greek tradition, there were times that the deities, the gods that were worshipped by the Greeks, would disguise themselves. And they would test the human beings to see if they were being faithful. Okay? And so it's interesting that the writer of Acts is using the medium of their culture. He's using their stories to illustrate his own point. And again, I think that's a powerful point to us today as believers saying, how do we reach our culture? Are we afraid to use the medium of our own culture to reach? Is it okay for me to teach my boys a very important lesson using Star Wars in the battle between good and evil to do so? Yes. Because sometimes that's the only way you'll reach individuals, because it's what they know. And so we have this illustrated here very plainly. So this is the tale of Baucis and Philemon. The story is set in the region called Phrygia. And so that's the area that I've highlighted there off to the left. So there's two gods in this story. The two gods are, guess what? Hermes and Zeus in this story. And they decide to conceal their identity. They decide to take on the look and the form of human beings. So they come and they're walking and traveling and journeying. And they come to this area. And they are tired and they're worn out. And they knock on all the doors they can find. They're knocking on every door. They don't have anywhere to go. No shelter. Nobody's answering the doors. The doors are locked. They knock on 1,000 doors, the story says. No one is showing these gods hospitality. Now, in some of the stories, the individuals are gone and doing other things because they're actually expecting the god Zeus to show up. And so they're trying to prepare everything that they have and keep all their best stuff, because when Zeus shows up, we really want to give him treatment. But these two beggars are showing up, and nobody's there. Nobody's home. Nobody's giving them hospitality. Finally, they come upon this humble little shack, and they find a hospitable couple there named Baucis and Philemon. They were a very old couple. They'd been married many, many years, and they were so much in love. They were impoverished, but they were very content. They hadn't spent their life in attempts at making wealth or any such thing. They took the gods in, not knowing they were gods, and they provided with them all they could out of their meager provisions. They gave them food and small comforts. They gave them a bed. They washed their feet. They dried the sweat off their forehead. They gave them their beds to sleep. Baucis and Philemon actually slept on the floor so that these two beggars could have their beds. And so Baucis started to notice some interesting things when she was using the pitcher to fill the cup of one of the strangers. She noticed that the pitcher wasn't running out. It stayed full. And one of the individuals touched a plate or an ornament, and it turned to gold. And so after a few series of events, they realized that these guests were actually gods. In the story, in the Greek world, when the gods who had been previously disguised, when their identities were known, they wouldn't deny it. They would say, yes, we are the gods, and then they would go on to reward or punish or whatever it is. So that's an important aspect of the story. The Baucis and Philemon, they apologized for the humble conditions of their house. And Philemon actually was going to go and kill the only goose that they had, which kind of served as a guard dog to their house. And before Philemon could kill it, the goose jumped in the lap of Zeus. Zeus told them, don't do this. You need to leave town. And so they all decided to flee to the mountains. They said that the neighbors of Baucis and Philemon, they said, your neighbors are very rich, but they're very inhospitable. They don't take care of others. And so the gods say, you need to go up the mountain, don't look back. And they destroyed the town. When they got to the top, they saw that the entire town was destroyed by a flood, except Baucis and Philemon's home. Their little humble hut had been turned into a temple. The couple was asked what their wish would be, and they said they wanted to be guardians in the temple of Zeus. And they also requested that they would die together. One didn't want to proceed in death before the other. They wanted to die together. And so upon their death, they turned into a pair of intertwined trees, one an oak and one a linden tree, and that stood in the terrain. So this story is in the mind of these individuals when Paul and Barnabas come waltzing in, exercising power that they thought could only be the gods' power. So they assumed, ooh, the gods are back. We got to take care of them this time. We don't want to suffer the fate that we suffered last time. So we're going to provide for them. So back in our story, it says the priest of Zeus comes out, and he brings all kinds of sacrificing material and provision, and they want to offer sacrifice to Paul and to Barnabas. But Paul and Barnabas, they don't reveal their deity or their divinity. They do the opposite. They plead their mortality. No! No, you're misunderstanding. Why are you doing this? They tore their clothes, which is a Jewish way to say, I'm at the bottom of my rope. I'm in turmoil. Why are you doing this? We're bringing you good news. Turn away from worshiping these worthless things, they call them, to worship the true, the living God. Unlike Zeus, this God is the creator of everything that you see. He's the creator of all. In past generations, God has overlooked these things. And this is an argument that Paul will actually take with him into Acts chapter 17 when he's arguing. So, through their pleading, it says they could hardly keep these individuals from sacrificing to them. So, again, this is where I want to stop and look at the idea of hospitality. Look how important hospitality was, not only in the Greek mind, but you have the same thing play out in the Jewish mind as well. And so, considering our own views of hospitality, those things have changed over the years. We live in a culture where we're very self-sufficient, very individualistic. And so, what does hospitality look like in our current day and age? What does it look like? What does it look like as individuals? What does it look like as a community of God? What does it look like for a community that's larger, as a nation, as a state, as a county, whatever it is? And those are questions that we all have to answer for ourselves. But then, in our story, the tables are turned. So when some came to this city from Antioch and Iconium, who had previously stirred up trouble, Paul's stoned. He's dragged out of the city, and they presume he's dead. The disciples surround him, but he gets back up and goes back into the city. Wow, these people are really interested in what I had to say. Look how far they went. This is the attitude of Paul. So this, on one account, this is kind of meant to illustrate the barbarianism that's being exercised by this town, who before they're trying to sacrifice to him as gods, the next minute they're trying to lynch him. So you have this extremism that's happening. And so Paul, through this whole ordeal, is presented as somewhat of a hero because he gets up from getting stoned with, again, presumably only a minor bruise or two, because he's still able to walk, he goes right back into the city. So this is kind of a theologically important point that is being illustrated through Paul's passion. And that is that the messenger of God is not ultimately discouraged, but will stay on his task with passion. That's the passion that's igniting his soul. And we see this driving Paul. But then we also have a second point, which is not necessarily a theological point, but it's kind of a poetic sense of justice that's happening here. There's a concept in Hebrew called measure for measure, midah keneged midah. And it means what you deal out. Like a good example would be Samson. Samson, it says, saw and lusted and went after, and he had the sin of his eyes. What did Samson end up losing? He lost his eyes. So it's this measure for measure idea. So Paul, Saul then, is kind of paying, in a poetic sense, is paying the price for his role that he played in Stephen's stoning. So it's not necessarily, again, like I said, it's not a theological point that one has to pay his own debt in that sense. It's saying that he's having to face that which he put onto another. How the tables turned. How would you like it if it happened to you, type thing. So that's what's happening here too. Okay, so then the next day, he and Barnabas went to Derbe. And after proclaiming the good news and making many disciples. Now, I want to give a little bit of a bookmark here for you to take. Not for next time, but in a couple chapters, I'm going to come back to this and have you remember about this event, because it's important. It comes into the story. So after making many disciples, they returned to Lystra. Then they returned to Iconium. And then they went on to Antioch. And it says they encouraged everyone there. And he said, Paul is saying, through much suffering, we enter the kingdom of God. And I think this is a very true point. And what does the suffering look like from time to time, to individual to individual? Suffering takes on a lot of different shapes. It can look like a form of controversy. It can look like the thing that divides the people of God. That can produce suffering. Something that can come between spouses, siblings, parents, friends. All of this can produce different types of suffering. It's not necessarily always physical suffering or persecution in that sense. And sometimes, a lot of times, there's nothing we can do about it except remember that God gives us a passion for staying true and staying firm on what he is asking of us. So then it's off through Pisidia and Pamphylia, and then they preached in Perga, and then went down to Attaliah. And then they returned back to Antioch, the Syrian Antioch. The assembly, the church there, is called together, and like true to form in our story that's being told, they recount their own story of everything that took place in the however long it took them to do this journey. They recount everything that had happened, and they stayed there for quite a while, for some time, it says. Now, we come to the conclusion. I want to kind of tie together a few of these thoughts that we've had. Last week, I mentioned about the crossroads of the culture, how God put this community, this assembly, God put his message right smack in the middle of the metropolis, right where culture was happening. And so what does that look like for us? And so that comes onto, on that, I want to build what I was saying earlier about political polarization. Sometimes we think that it has to be either this or this. Well, maybe there's room for disagreement sometimes. It doesn't have to always be one or the other. We find that same thing happen with religious polarization. That sometimes we have to be so, we try to define everything so well that we cut ourselves out of the blessing that God may be wanting to give us through those who may not see things the same way that we do. Is it our duty then to put persecution onto them or to try to tear them down or to try to bring opposition into their life, to chase them down, whatever it takes? That has been the operation of many, many Christians through the years of church history. And unfortunately, it's led to unprecedented amounts of persecution, even those being killed for not seeing it the right way. We have many brothers and sisters throughout this world who see things much differently than we do. That doesn't always make them wrong. And again, we rob ourselves the blessing and that which can even challenge us through somebody who sees it a little bit differently than we do. They may see a side that we've never seen before. And so that's a warning to all of us to be very careful about casting our own judgment based on what we think is right and what we've just been taught is right. Sometimes those things can be wrong. And then one of the major points that I find here is this hospitality, told in that amazing story and brought into our own, into the story of Acts. And you know, what does it look like in our day to be hospitable? It's not always about feeding someone or placing a roof over someone's head. It may be going and sitting down and having coffee with someone who needs it. Somebody who needs to talk and they have no one else to turn to. That may be hospitality. It may be hospitality to give a cup of cold water in the name of Jesus. Maybe hospitality. So it takes many different forms, but we have to have eyes to be able to see those things. We have to be putting ourselves sometimes out of our comfort zone, putting ourselves out of our track. And I appreciated what was said this morning about newness, about challenging ourselves to step outside of everything that we constantly know. Something that we are very habitual beings to where we can do the same thing over and over, and we just accept it that way. Not that it's necessarily wrong, but sometimes, again, we're robbed of the blessing that God wants to bring into our lives because we're just keeping the same track without challenging ourselves, without looking and having eyes to see, where is God leading me? Does God want me to step outside this to aid someone else? It's not just about us. So the tale of Baucis and Philemon in the context of our story reflect what the writer of Hebrews wrote. The writer of Hebrews said, "Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for by doing that, some have entertained angels without even knowing it." And we have the same thing that happened in with the story of Abraham, the story of Lot. This hospitality is very ingrained in their culture. And again, it's something that we should not be afraid of, and we should seek in earnestness to say, where does God want me to reach out to others?